I've really been looking forward to coming up here because I've never been to this part of the country really before. I was here 8 years ago in Boston to see a Red Sox game and drive over to Cooperstown to the Hall of Fame with some college friends, but that's been the extent of my experience in New England. And I flew in Thursday and rented a car and made a big circuit of the area and can now say I've been in all the New England states. But I've been looking forward to meeting with the church here. I wasn't sure how I got contacted to get here, and I asked Mike about that, and he happened to read something I had written on the subject matter that we're going to be looking at today, and the elders had said something about wanting to have some studies on evidences, and my name somehow came up, and I got invited, and I'm sure glad it did. Now, I've met Wally and Sandy because I preached in Nashville for the group that they were members of when they were in, or at least when Wally was in college. And is that right, Wally? Have I got that story right? So yeah, it's sort of a 30-second cousin to what actually happened, but they know the folks real well where I preached in Nashville and met them a couple of times when they were there visiting. So that's pretty much the extent of my contact with you. I was born and raised in East Central Illinois, born in Champaign, raised on a farm about 100 miles south of Chicago. And my study in the area of evidences and this subject began with an ad that appeared in the Champaign, Illinois newspaper, probably 25, 30 years ago, that was placed there by the president of the American Atheist Association for Central Illinois. And he was sort of throwing down the gauntlet. I can't remember what the ad was about, but he was insulting anybody who had any kind of belief in the God of the Bible. And I saw it and couldn't let it pass and contacted him. And one thing led to another. And it ended up in 1985. We had a debate on the campus of the University of Illinois. And in preparing for that debate, the studies that I did, and thereafter, I had a second debate in 1988 at Iowa State University with a professor of thermodynamics, and that's what became the catalyst for me doing some study in this area. And in this first class this morning, we're going to be on a subject that I'm not technically or professionally qualified to speak on. I'm going to be talking about some scientific concerns this morning, but even beyond that, I'm going to be talking about common sense. We're on firm biblical ground in a study like this because there are many times when Christ, being challenged by various adversaries, responded in part not by making an appeal to the Old Testament, but by turning the person's argument against them by putting the monkey on their back by saying, here's some things that don't hold water and don't make sense. And that's sort of the aim of this first study this morning, to look at the beliefs of unbelievers from a common sense perspective. And at least to my way of thinking, here's some things that you're just going to have to help me with because they don't make a whole lot of sense to me. I've got a couple of brothers who are scientists. I tell people I have two brothers who are Christian scientists, and they kind of look at me like, you know, what does that mean? But they're Christians and they're scientists, and they could go into a lot greater technical detail than I can. But if you think you've got a handle on common sense, maybe we can get something out of this study here to begin with today. I want to begin by talking about the three characteristics of our age, the kind of people we're dealing with, for the most part, in our contacts and studies with them. And the first, I hit the wrong button, the first characteristic is that this is a global age, and by that word I mean everybody lives next door to everybody else on the planet pretty much anymore. The recent riots they had in Iran over the election there were being broadcast into any home that had access to the internet almost as fast as they happened on this Twitter. And I'm not sure what Twitter is, but I know you could get on Twitter and see the scenes as they were transpiring. YouTube, email, Facebook. I mean, the world has shrunk beyond anybody's conception just a few years ago because of the information age and the revolution in technology and the internet and such things. So we pretty much can know what's going on just about anywhere in the world. And in regard to that, we realize that there's a great deal of pluralism in this world. 100 years ago in this country, everybody pretty much believed the same thing. That is not the case anymore. You go down to the Walmart, you're as liable to bump into someone who came from a culture where they worshiped their ancestors, their parents. And then you go down the next aisle, you might bump into someone who comes from a culture where they eat their parents. We don't believe the same thing anymore. We come from all kinds of beliefs and belief systems. And I would say that the predominant belief we bump into with the people we meet and encounter is secular. We do not live in a Christian dominated culture any longer. I'm not sure we ever did, but in the strictest sense, but we certainly don't live in a Bible dominated society anymore. Secularism is the main rule of the day, and the public schools are very adept at promoting secularism. We did not get to this point in this country overnight. I think we got here over the course of the past 3 centuries. How did we get to where we are in this country where things that a few years ago would have been unimaginable to have allowed to transpire in our society routinely occur nowadays? Well, I would say in my analysis that it all began in the 18th century when the Bible was killed. I was down in Boston yesterday looking at some of the revolutionary sites, and the fact of the matter is many of the founding fathers were not Christian in any traditional sense. They were deists. And deists were people, as you may know, who believed that there was a God, but did not believe that God had revealed himself in any special, unique way to man. They did not believe that the Bible was the Word of God. The Jefferson Bible was where Jefferson took a Bible and cut out all of the miraculous elements, pretty much, took scissors to it. And what was left, the morality in the Bible, was a system he was willing to endorse. But men like Jefferson, Thomas Paine, Benjamin Franklin, even Washington to some extent, and I could go on and on, there were exceptions, but many of them were deists in their thinking. The remaining vestige of deism today would be the Masons. They believed in nature's God. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We don't need a special revelation. Just go out and look around and you can figure this out for yourself. So in the 18th century, the Bible was killed. In the 19th century, God was killed. There were men in the 19th century who, when they looked at nature, they didn't see nature's God. They saw a situation where might made right. They saw the survival of the fittest. And it was in the 19th century that an Austrian philosopher by the name of Friedrich Nietzsche coined the phrase, God is dead, in his book, Frauliche Wissenschaft, The Joyful Science. And he sort of realized the consequences of killing God, but he killed him off nevertheless. Well, the result of the Bible being killed in the 18th and God being killed in the 19th is that in the 20th century, man was killed. There was greater destruction of man by his fellows in the 20th century than in all of recorded history to that point, as far as we can tell. When you think of men like Hitler and Stalin and the terrible killing in World War I and Mao Zedong and Pol Pot and Idi Amin and just on and on, abortion. More men died violently in the 20th century than had been recorded in history to that point as a result of God being killed, as a result of the Bible being killed. And the situation we live in today is as much like the situation in which the gospel was originally preached in the first century than maybe any intervening century, which means we've got a golden opportunity to give people what they want more than anything. I was impressed with this in reading a book called Through the Valley of the Kwai a number of years ago, written by a British naval officer who, with a few other officers, escaped from Singapore there in Malaysia when the Japanese invaded. And they were experienced seamen, but before the war, the author had been the typical urbane, sophisticated, worldly Englishman, sailing yachts, going to college, that kind of thing. He went into the Navy with the outbreak of the war, and then when the Japanese came down, he and some friends went over to the coast and bought a boat from some native folks that had an engine of some sort on it, and they were going to sail across the Indian Ocean to India. And they had been out about 3 weeks. They were all experienced sailors, and they thought they were home free. And one day, some masts appeared on the horizon. Turned out to be some Japanese destroyers. They were spotted. They were taken on board. They were taken to Burma, and they ended up in the prison camps there in the Valley of the Kwai. If you saw the movie The Bridge Over the River Kwai, that's the same kind of story, only very fictionalized. The author describes how in these Japanese camps, those prisoners lost everything. They had everything taken from them, not just their freedom, but their health, their decency. They became savages, turning on each other, fighting over rats and mice and bugs because they were starving. But he talked about how somehow, one day, a Bible turned up in camp. And men would tear pages out of the Bible and read it and pass the page to their neighbor, and the Bible circulated its way through camp that way. And he describes the amazing change that came over the prisoners as they read the Bible. They started helping each other, washing each other's wounds and taking care of each other's diseases as best they could, giving their food to those who were more sick. And he said the thing he learned in the prison camp is that there are only three things that a man needs in order to live a radiant, meaningful, significant life. And those three things were faith, hope, and love. He said if you got those three, you've got all you need. And that's what people in our society need. And we're in a position, we're in the best position to give people those things. Now, let me talk about four considerations. These are four I use. Maybe you'll find them helpful. I hope so. If not, you know, maybe you'll come across something else that will help you in your discussions with unbelievers. What I've discovered is that in talking with an unbeliever, they often try to make you feel like an idiot. And they often do that by using sophisticated technical terms that you're not familiar with. But you have two reasons for responding to the unbelief of the time. The first reason is you've got a brain just like the unbeliever does. And the second reason is you have access to the same data, the same information he's got access to that he looks at and draws the bottom line, says, you see here, this proves there is no God. You can look at the data yourself and draw your bottom line and see what the data indicates to you. Now, in any discussion, the first thing you have to do is to establish common ground. And we have common ground with unbelievers. Now, remember, to call a person an unbeliever doesn't mean they don't have any beliefs. Unbelievers got more beliefs than I ever thought about having, and some of them are unbelievable. I want us to look at the common ground, the starting belief we have in common with unbelievers. And that is that something has always existed. Believer or unbeliever makes no difference unless you're just completely insane. Everybody agrees there is something out there. There's something here right now that exists. The question becomes, how did what exists get here. Nobody believes that something can come from nothing. If there was ever a moment, if I can even use that kind of language, when there was absolutely nothing, no time, no mass, no matter, no energy, I mean nothing. You can mark it down, there wouldn't be anything now. The fact that there is something now implies there was something before now that gave rise to what's now. Everything about us is contingent. Everything that we see, that we know about, is dependent on something else. And since no one can imagine how something could come from nothing, the assumption is that something has always existed. Everybody believes that. The difference between believers and unbelievers is the nature of that something. Sometimes unbelievers scoff at believers. You think God made everything? Ha ha, who made God? Well, unbelievers believe matter is to explain for everything, and we can ask them the same thing. If matter explains everything, who made matter? I mean, every way in which they attempt to ridicule us can be turned against them. The same question can be asked them. But that's our starting point with the unbeliever. That's the common ground. We all believe that something has existed forever. We believe it's God. We believe it's intelligence. They believe it's matter. They believe it is non-intelligence, and I'll just discuss this further using the word cosmology. And that's a fancy word, but that just refers to the study of the cosmos, the universe. And it asks, among other things, the question, where did this universe come from? Now, as I said, whether you're a believer or an atheist, you believe that there was an uncaused cause. Everything we see in this world has a cause. Cause and effect. Here's something that happened. Here's what resulted as a consequence. Everybody believes, though, there has to be something that had no cause. It was eternally self-existent. It's always been. I don't think there's any other option to explain where the cosmos came from. Now let me point out something that I've noticed, and you've probably noticed in listening to unbelievers or talking with them, when they're talking about the origin of life. And that's kind of where I'm headed under this heading of cosmology. Where did life come from? They always start with some assumptions. Unbelievers always start with some assumptions that they really don't like to talk about. In fact, when you try to talk about these assumptions with them, they want to get the topic off what they believe onto what you believe as quickly as possible. But here's where they typically start their discussion. They want to start talking about, say, the Big Bang. That's where they want to start the conversation. But that starting point begs the question, before the Big Bang, there had to be something to bang, you know, to go boom. Where did that stuff come? Oh, they'll say, all the matter in the universe was compacted down. Before the Big Bang was the Big Crunch. And that's what exploded in the Big Bang. Okay, I know that. I understand that. But where did all that stuff that was compacted down to come from? And when you get to that point, you're sort of getting to ground zero with these folks. I don't know if you've seen the movie that came out about a year ago called Expelled by Ben Stein. Probably everybody here would know Ben Stein if saw him. He's been in a bunch of movies. He had a TV show, Ben Stein's Money. The guy's a brilliant individual. I think he's got two PhDs. Got at least one. He was a speechwriter for Nixon, sort of a hippie who left that lifestyle. And he produced this movie about how any reference to intelligent design has been expelled from the public classrooms in America. And he arranged an interview with the world's number one atheist, the guy considered the number one atheist in the world today, an Englishman by the name of Richard Dawkins. And he talked to Dawkins, and he talked to some other atheists, and he asked them, where did it all come from? And you want to see some squirming around. And you want to see some guys getting irritated at the question. One fellow, I forget the scientist's name, atheist, was asked by Ben Stein, where did life come from? And he said, well, molecules piggybacked onto crystals. Okay, where did the molecules come from? I told you. They piggybacked onto crystals. Ben said, I know what you said, but I'm asking, where did they come from? And the guy just got mad. Dawkins said, I don't know where it came from. He just knows it didn't come from God, but other than that, he doesn't know where it came from. Francis Crick, who helped crack the DNA genetic code, very famous scientist, believed that life on Earth was seeded by space aliens, another civilization, and Dawkins allowed the possibility of that being the explanation for life on Earth, but he said, of course, wherever that or whatever that other civilization was, space aliens, they had to have natural explanations for how they came about. So when you get into that point, what do you find out? They're clueless. They have no idea. But even when you grant them their assumptions, they've got a major problem. They want to talk about evolution and how life evolved from a single cell molecule or organism. But let me tell you the biggest missing link of all. It's the link between non-life and life. And here's another way in which believers and unbelievers are alike. Everybody believes that somehow or other, life came from what was not living. That one moment, here's something that's not living or dead. The next moment, here's something that's alive. Now, that's going to be the third study today where we talk about what the Bible has in mind when it talks about something coming from the dead. But atheists also believe there was a moment when there was no life of any sort, and the next moment there was life. How did that happen? You ask them. And again, you've got to really follow them because they're going to try to throw you off the scent. They're going to assume things. They're going to try to get things into the discussion that they just assumed that beg the question even further. When you ask atheists how life came about, one thing they'll talk about is antecedent subsequent probability. There are some who have tried to argue that the odds of life evolving are so astronomical they're virtually zero. That doesn't faze an atheist. It's like if you were trying to calculate the odds of a crow picking up a pebble in its mouth, and you draw an inch square on the ground, and you're trying to calculate the odds of that crow happening to fly over and drop that pebble so it lands right in the inch square you've drawn. You know, when you're prior to the event, calculating the event, the odds may be virtually zero, just astronomical. But once it's happened, once the crow has dropped the pebble and lands in your square inch, the subsequent probability, did I do something? Does that go off sometimes? Not supposed to? Okay, I probably broke it. But the subsequent probability is out the window because once it's happened. Doesn't matter how many times it had to be tried before it happened or what the odds were. They say once it's happened, it's just happened. I got it back, but I may hit the wrong thing. Yeah, blame me, Bo. It's always the operator, never the technology. I found it does very little good to talk with them about the odds against evolution and such things. But what I do talk with them about are some of the things they want to claim prove how life may have arisen. They will talk about the experiments done back in the 50s by Stanley Miller. That's called chemical evolution. And what Miller did, he was a junior engineer. I forget where he worked at that time. But in 1953, thereabout, he went into the lab and created what he envisioned to be the primordial soup. He put in some hydrogen, and he put in some methane, and some ammonia, and some water, and he shot an electric current through it, and he'd go back and check it periodically. And after about a week, he saw that there was something there, and it was tested, and it turned out to be amino acids of some sort. Sort of a tar-like substance. Since then, other scientists have tried to carry further with this work of his, and has gotten nowhere, and they've pretty much abandoned it, but you'll still hear chemical evolution, the work of Urey and Miller and some of these guys, cited as an explanation of how life could have arisen from non-life, and it does no such thing. If anything, what Miller's experiments prove is that intelligence can put together some pre-existing elements and can do stuff to them and get something that's not living. Amino acids are not life. They're as dead as a doornail. But there's a mind behind all of that trying to manipulate it. So chemical evolution is no solution. When I was a sophomore in high school, our biology textbook was Modern Biology by a fellow by the name of Towle, T-O-W-L-E, and I have never forgot. I remember reading at the time as a stupid sophomore, this is nuts. The second chapter was on cosmology, how life arose. The entire chapter was spent arguing that every scientific experiment that's ever been performed proves that life only comes from life. It ridiculed the beliefs of the medievals who thought that you could get flies from clay and such things. And so you come down to the end of the chapter. Here's their conclusion. Life comes only from life. However, we cannot assume that abiogenesis has never occurred nor that it could never happen again. Spontaneous generation. You know, and this is where the beliefs of the unbelievers become very, not only unscientific, but anti-scientific. They believe that matter has existed forever, even though things such as the second law of thermodynamics says, no way. There's not a single experiment, observation that's ever been made to indicate how matter could exist forever. Everything that has been learned about matter says it can't. Everything we know about life says it only comes from prior life. But this kind of nonsense, maybe life just suddenly sprang into existence. That's what the word abiogenesis or spontaneous generation means. That's what they're reduced to. And if any of you have access to a high school or college biology book, see if they've got a chapter on such things, and see if they even offer an explanation as to how life might have risen. there's a book, came out a few years ago, I saw that Mo has it at home, by a Lehigh University associate professor, at least he was when he wrote it, or assistant professor, I can't remember, Michael Behe. And he wrote a book called Darwin's Black Box. And again, from a common sense standpoint, it makes to me all sense in the world. And he points out in the past 50 or so years, with microbiology sort of exploding on the scene, scientists have learned things about life that they really didn't have much of a clue about before. For instance, when you hear the euphemism simple cell organism, What we now know is that a cell, even the simplest of cells, is about as simple as a Saturn V rocket. They are highly complex entities. But the evolutionists, the unbelievers, like to throw out these euphemisms that sort of take us into believing that maybe they are simple after all. Well, Behe, in his book Darwin's Black Box, talks about things he refers to as being irreducibly complex, which means in order for a system to function, all of the parts of the system have to be present at the same time. That they could not have evolved and the system function or work. And the illustration he gives is of a mouse trap. To catch mice with a mouse trap, you've got to have a minimum of five components. You've got to have the platform there, the piece of wood, and you've got to have the spring and the bar, you know, the latch and here and those five things. Take away one of those five things, pick any one, and you're not going to catch a mouse with it. And he says in the body there are systems like this where everything has to be present at the same time for it to work. And one illustration I could understand from his book, halfway, I couldn't stay up with all of them, but he was talking about blood clotting, the blood clotting factor in the blood. If blood doesn't clot, we call that hemophilia. If blood clots when it shouldn't clot, you got a clogged artery. If your blood won't clot, if it clots when it shouldn't, you're not going to be around very long. But for blood to clot, he talks about all of these proteins that have to be present at one at the same time for the blood clotting mechanism in us to work properly. No way in the world those systems could have evolved and sustained life, at least as we know it. And so, the work of people like Behe. And let me point out again, and anytime you hear a lesson on evolution, this is mentioned because it is so important. In Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, Darwin describes change and variation within an animal order. He used that change and variation within an animal order to argue that one animal order can change into another animal order. Nobody denies the fact. I used to raise pheasants. There are over 50 species of pheasants. They're all pheasants. Anybody who knows anything about pheasants isn't going to deny that an impaled pheasant does not look like a golden pheasant, which does not look like a blue-eared pheasant or a Reeves pheasant, you know, just on and on. They all look different, but they're all pheasants. But the change in variation that's witnessed within the pheasant family does not argue that a pheasant can turn into a fox. But that's what Darwinists argue, that the change in variation within one family shows how one family can become another family entirely, and most people understand that's just bogus. Well, after talking about cosmology, the third place I go to is talking about the consequences of cosmology, unbelieving cosmology. We all start the same place. We come to a fork in the road, we take different forks, we take the fork toward intelligent design, a designer, a creator. They take the fork toward no intelligent, non-living matter. One of the things we need to ask is, what are the consequences of the fork they take? And the consequences are extremely serious. And one of the ways I point them out is by noting that whatever formula they give you that they claim shows how man got here, T plus E plus C. Time plus energy plus chance. Whatever formula they give you that they say is the explanation for man is the same formula that's the explanation for mosquitoes. Or for mice. Whatever produced man produced everything else, which means man is not qualitatively different from anything else. And there are people who believe this, and the consequences of their belief have been horrendous. There was a little Austrian house painter who read Nietzsche, who read what Nietzsche said, not only about God being dead, but he read Thus Spake Zarathustra, which has been referred to as the atheistic Bible, in which Nietzsche advocated the idea that man could become a superman, by which he meant man could create a utopia. Man could create a system in which man's own beliefs and value systems are imposed on the weaker. And this little Austrian house painter thought he was a superman, and when he got power and tried to impose his system on society, part of his system said, Jews have no value. Gypsies have no value. The insane have no value. And they murdered him. Hitler saw his race theories as a continuation of Darwin's natural selection. The survival of the fittest. And value being determined by whoever is strong enough to impose his will on others. And those race theories, that Darwinistic template applied to society is still with us today. And what that kind of thinking strikes at are the most vulnerable among us, and those are typically the very young and the very old. They're the ones who stand most in danger of being victimized by that sort of unbelieving thinking. And I think there are things in our society that's going on even now, some of the discussions that politicians are having, decisions that bureaucrats are making, that still target these vulnerable elements in society. And it all traces back to the view that somebody along the line has that man really is no different from any other organism, any other creature, and they can be treated just the same way we would treat any other type of vermin or creature that is of no value to us. That's the consequence for culture of unbelieving thinking. Now let me add a fourth thing here. And that's to ask the question, what really produces an atheist? It just doesn't add up, folks. I mean, when you think about what has to be proven for them to prove that matter is eternal, or for them to prove how life could come from non-life, anybody with half a brain can see it just doesn't add up. So why are there atheists? Turn to Ephesians chapter 4. In verses 17 to 22, I think Paul gives the real explanation behind unbelief. Ephesians 4, starting with verse 17. And I left my reading glasses at home, so if I fade out here somewhere, just keep reading. I'll pick up where I can see it. Verse 17. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that ye henceforth walk not as other Gentiles walk in the vanity of their minds, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. But ye have not so learned Christ, if so be that ye have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus. And then he goes on to talk about putting off the old man and putting on the new man. Paul's exhortation is, don't walk. Don't live like. The word walk refers to lifestyle. Don't live like Gentiles live. And then he describes the Gentile lifestyle. And there are four elements to the Gentile lifestyle. And I think you can read verses 18 and 19 there and put them in order. And before I give you the order I see, let me tell you this. I have never met an atheist who didn't have a story. In fact, anymore, the first thing I ask him is, what's your story? What's really going on here? I debated Dr. John Patterson, professor of thermodynamics at Iowa State, because my brother is a professor at Iowa State, and he knew John, and John is a very vocal, or was 20 years ago, a very vocal atheist in that community, and my brother arranged the discussion. And I went over and met with John before the debate, the day of the debate, and very personable, nice fella, really enjoyed talking with him, and in the course of the discussion, learn that he had been raised by very strict Pentecostal parents. And he would ask them questions like, well, if miracles are occurring today, if there are miracles of healing today, why aren't we down at the hospital cleaning it out? And they'd smack his mouth or box his ears or tell him to shut up. And he grew up being treated like that. Is anybody surprised that he became an unbeliever in reaction to that kind of upbringing? I've never met an atheist who doesn't have a story. And here's the order I see in verses 17 and 18 with Paul talking about the Gentile outlook on life. It all starts, the King James says blindness of heart, most other versions say hardness of heart. Unbelief starts with a decision you make in your heart to close yourself, to close it to the light, to close it to evidence, to close it to common sense, to rationality. And from there it leads, and there are three phrases that describe the next level. It leads to vanity of mind, to a darkened understanding, and to the ignorance that is in them. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. When you close yourself to the truth and the light, you're going to end up believing the most unbelievable things and calling it smart. The third stage in the descent into Gentilism is being alienated from the life of God. Being filled with ignorance because you've hardened your heart to the light, to the truth, you end up cut off from God. And the fourth stage there is in verse 19, giving themselves over to recklessness, to lasciviousness, not necessarily wild and wanton living, but recklessness in all kinds of thinking and lifestyles that are not godly. But it all starts with a hardened heart. It does not start with evidence that says there is no God. It starts with a decision to close your heart to the evidence. In the next lesson and in the third lesson, we're going to look at the evidence. And I'll just lay it out because I think that's what the apostles do. They just lay it out and call upon people to look at it and make up their own mind. And so we'll get to that. Thank you very much for your kind attention this morning.